Hello, this is Terrence McNally. In today's fractionalized and polarized world, facts and reality are too often less important than which narrative you embrace or which stories you believe. Here's my 2012 conversation with Jonas Sachs, co-founder of Free Range Studios, the folks behind The Story of Stuff, and author of Winning the Story Wars. Learn how this works and how to use it to your advantage. Hello, this is Terrence McNally. Today in culture and politics, too often facts and reality are less important than which narrative you embrace or which stories you believe. This week, you'll hear my December 2012 conversation with Jonas Sachs, co-founder of Free Range, the folks behind The Story of Stuff, and the author of Unsafe Thinking and Winning the Story Wars.
Have you heard or read any great stories lately? Better yet, have you told any? Jerome Bruner wrote that we exist in an interconnected web of stories. Our minds are hungry for them, and our minds also naturally generate them. Let's consider the most mundane of experiences. Someone is late meeting you. Do you create a story or stories as you wait for them to show up? You know, I hope they're all right. I hope nothing happened to them. Or the opposite. He's always late. Why is he so inconsiderate? Why doesn't he think about me? Or say you're the one that's running late. Do you tell yourself things like, she's going to judge me, or are you already making up the story that you're going to tell her about the traffic or the last-minute phone call you had to take or the colleague who wouldn't stop talking as you tried to leave? Those are just some of the unending stream of stories that surround us. And then there are the larger, more significant stories, the stories we tell ourselves about who we are, about why our life works or doesn't, for example. And finally, there are the even larger shared stories that influence the larger society, stories of politics, religion, national culture, human nature. My guest today is Jonas Sachs, author of Winning the Story Wars, Why Those Who Tell and Live the Best Stories Will Rule the Future. He's also creative director at Free Range Studios, and on their homepage, you'll see this quote, "Great stories make great change possible. Your world-changing message deserves to be heard, really heard, but that only happens when you learn to tell a great story." My website, by the way, is either terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, and on my homepage, you'll see this quote, "On the radio, I tell stories of a world that just might work, and as a consultant, I help you tell yours." As I've shared before, after time as a teacher, 2 decades in the entertainment industry, 15 years as a radio host, I now also work with nonprofits, foundations, public agencies, and businesses to help them tell better stories and build better narratives. Jonah's company, Free Range, is responsible for many wonderful campaigns, 2 of which, The Metrix and The Story of Stuff, are among the most successful videos ever in terms of viral circulation to millions. Understanding the power of narrative and mastering the ability to develop and share interesting and memorable stories can make you more effective at nearly everything you do, at home or at work, with your family, or with the world at large. Jonah Sachs, co-founder and creative director of Free Range, has worked with hundreds of social brands and causes. His work on viral videos, as I said, like Metrix and Story of Stuff, has brought key social issues to the attention of more than 60 million viewers. His interactive work has been honored with Best of Awards 3 times at the South by Southwest Interactive Festival. Jonah and his work have been featured in the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, Fox News, Sundance Film Festival, NPR, The Colbert Report, Fast Company, which named him one of the 50 most influential social innovators. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives and the work and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Welcome, Jonas Sachs, to Free Forum.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So, Jonas, could you tell us a bit about your path to the work that you do today, and feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision?
Sure. Well, when I was 22 years old and fresh out of college, I had this deep attraction to the advertising industry. I wasn't really sure what it was, but I loved the idea of the short form creativity to try to move people to action, and thought that, you know, somehow I was destined to be in advertising. And I started working my way toward that goal, first contacting a childhood friend of mine who I had been making movies with since I was 7 years old and said, you know, let's take a crack at getting into this industry of getting people to change the way they behave based on telling great stories. And we sort of started working our way toward that goal and suddenly looked at each other after coming up with this, in 1999, this web-based way of getting people to do a treasure hunt to major corporate sites. We were working on this idea of getting people to go to these big corporate sites on a treasure hunt in a game through a story, and we said, why are we doing this? Why do we want to drive people to do things that we wouldn't even want to do ourselves? And if we're looking to give ourselves a megaphone to reach millions of people, why would we want to shout messages we don't really believe? And that was kind of our first aha moment, which was, wait a minute, there's got to be a way to do exactly what we love, which is using creativity to change actions, but to use it for social change. And the first question we asked is, well, why is that, if that's possible, why has it been so hard? And we looked and said, you know, the reason is that before, we lived in a sort of broadcast era where you had to be rich, you had to have power, you had to have control of these broadcast machines in order to be heard. Everyone else was just a consumer. But in 1999, the internet was, you know, kind of just emerging as this tool where everybody could be a producer of content. So we had this thought that we could divert our careers and hopefully change the world in some way by using these new tools to make everybody a producer and a sharer of the kind of messages that they most cared about. So we founded this company, Free Range Studios, back then to experiment with ways that we could help nonprofits and social brands start to really reach out and get people to pass messages of passion rather than simply advertisements around. And early on, we had a couple of really big successes that we didn't expect. You know, we were putting out all these fact-based communications, as most nonprofits did, and we started deciding to make little stories, little 30-second, one-minute animations way before the days of YouTube. And some of them we found we could kind of send out from our bedroom and reach hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people. In 2003, we made this spoof of the Matrix called The Matrix about factory farming. And that reached about 25 million people in really short order. And we had this incredible realization that people were eager to share stories that mattered to them and just absolutely ready to do it. And now it wouldn't be done in the old ways where you had to call a television executive to ask permission. You could just create them. But the big frustration was that some of the stories would go hugely viral and others would simply flop. And we had no idea why. And our clients were expecting us to continue to create those successes that we have had along the way. So we'd get 20 million, then we'd get 1,000, and then we'd get 20 million, and then we'd get 5 people watching it. And we just didn't know why, and I was feeling under deeper and deeper pressure, as I think any creative person gets, to live up to successes of the past. And that's when, in a sort of state of desperation, I started poking around and discovered, strangely for the first time, the work of Joseph Campbell, and really saw how the great stories that we tell and repeat are based on sort of ancient mythic patterns, and that while I had been so obsessed with how fast the world was changing and how new tools made new things possible, there was something constant and timeless about stories that I realized I needed to understand.
I like that. I like that sort of juxtaposition there, that what you're working in and what we're talking about today is both as new as what's happening today and tomorrow, and as old as human society.
Yeah, that was that, and in my book, one of the first insights that I start with, I think the first thing that we need to realize as we head down the path to better storytelling is that all of these crazy new tools that are connecting us through social networks, that are allowing us to create our own media, to comment on media, to pass it along, what it's really doing is returning us to the old way that people communicated, which is the oral tradition. So in the oral tradition, ideas weren't fixed on a piece of paper and then broadcast out to everybody. They were passed from teller to listener, and each listener would kind of make it their own and move it through unpredictable social networks. And that's what's happening now again. Human beings were evolved to communicate that way, and somehow it took, you know, all these incredible high-tech tools to bring us back to that old way of communication, which is the oral tradition. And in the oral tradition, stories absolutely dominated. So when you were in the time of making 30-second TV spots for television, you could just sort of create these announcements telling people what to do. But in the oral tradition, you actually have to tell stories if you want to be heard. So that's why I think so many people who want to be heard are talking again about the art of storytelling.
You covered a lot of ground in your answer to the first question. As I said, that this is a very interesting thing, that the old is new again and the new, you know, has connected with the old. Why is that? Is it because the thing that seems so different, of course, is that in the old, in the oral tradition, it was one-to-one, one to the people around the campfire. If someone was really a big deal, maybe one to the whole tribe, you know. And now it's one to millions.
Well, the one-to-millions approach is really, in my mind, a little bit of the aberration. So the one-to-millions was what we had when you had somebody, you know, wants to take a 30-second television spot out on Cheers, and you know that everybody's going to be tuning in on Thursday night, and you're going to have 40 million viewers on Cheers, and you just buy the spot. That's really the one-to-millions, because the people who are watching it see your ad for Pepsi, the Pepsi Challenge, and they have no choice but just to sort of consume it, let it pass. They can't comment on it. They can't push back against it. They can't make it their own. So that's the true one to millions, and that's really unnatural for human beings. We like to be participants in the stories that we hear and tell. What we have now is, yes, you know, something like The Matrix can reach 25 million people, but really it's the one. It's me creating it, but then it's sharing it with my evangelists and my friends and my social network. And then they take it and decide where to send it out to, what context within to push it, how to comment on it when it goes out. Sometimes they even mash it up and change it and make it their own and add new clips to it and put a new soundtrack on it. And that's what we're seeing with stories today, is that audiences participate in the spreading and creation of it, and they get a say along the way. So just like in the old days, these messages morph and change over time, and it's as important what we see said about it on Twitter as what the message is itself. That's the context that makes us understand it. So that's very much like what happened when a story like The Emperor's New Clothes moved from India to Scandinavia over the course of 1,000 years. The story remains the same, but the context in which it's told changes, and each person who holds it can make it their own along the way. That's what I think is so human, and that's what I think we're seeing with the internet. We're all curators of these stories, and we all participate in them, and I think it's a very positive sign for humanity. You know, you talk about, you know, a better world being possible. I think this is one of the key drivers of that.
Mm-hmm. And I agree, and partly it's because if we use the metaphor or the view of the 1% and the 99%, the old broadcast, that was to some extent the 1% of people who controlled media were the ones who got to put messages out.
Absolutely.
And the 99% were receivers. Now the 99% are participant. Henry Jenkins calls it participatory culture.
Exactly. I just wrote a blog post for a Harvard Business Review yesterday, or went up yesterday, about Danske Bank's Occupy ad that they
right.
put out.
So this is I read it. Tell people about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, here's what happened. The Danske Bank wanted to sort of appropriate a piece of 99% culture, which advertisers have always done. You know, there's a new cultural movement, there's a new artistic movement, and then the advertiser says, hey, we can make that part of our brand. Now, in the old days, the people who were part of that movement might shake their fists and say, hey, that was our movement. You can't use that to advertise Coke. But the everybody else watching it will just sort of shrug and say, hey, you know, I guess Coke's aligned with that new artistic movement. And it really worked to build brands. But now, here's what happens. Danske Bank says, well, obviously there's a new zeitgeist out there. People are distrustful of banks. People think that banks are the problem. Let's take that imagery and use it to say we're part of the solution, even though there was really no substantiation or nothing they were going to do differently. They take that imagery, they put it in their ad, so you see a picture of a guy with a dollar bill over his face and it says Occupy on it, and say, you know, there's a new normal, we have new standards. And in the old days, you know, the Occupy people would be angry, everybody else would say, hey, Danske Bank's got some new values. But now today, the Occupy people get to take to Twitter, get to draw people's attention to it, and show what Danske Bank's actually been doing, which is not in line with Occupy values, and the public gets to decide. And the public decided this was not a good use of Occupy imagery, and suddenly there's a wave of negative publicity. The bank has to, you know, change the ad, retract it, say they're sorry, and it suddenly becomes an ad for exactly what the exact opposite of what they were intending. So it's a lot less easy for advertisers to inappropriately appropriate culture than it was in the past. And again, I think that adds a new vitality to our culture, that we can sort of only confer its use on people who really deserve, who are living the truth that they're putting out there.
Right. As in your book, you start with a lot of the foundational things. The book is Winning the Story Wars by Jonah Sacks. Start a lot of foundational things, some of the stuff we've been talking about the power of story, about mythology, about the hero's journey, and so on. Towards the end, you go very much into this thing of you've got to live it, that authenticity becomes much more crucial than it ever did before.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's some really positive signs out there as more corporations want to use storytelling to be heard. This is a huge opportunity because stories are basically containers for values. You know, you have on a story, you'll have the characters and the conflict and the setting, on the things you see on the surface. And those are all placed there for a specific reason. And that's to illustrate a moral of the story, a core truth about how the world works. And then one level below that are the values upon which that truth are based. And so that's how all stories have always worked. They're really ways that people spread values. So if corporations want to tell stories better, I argue, they have to be very clear on the values that they are basing those stories on. And those values, in order to get passed along by audiences, need to resonate with audiences. And in the oral tradition, stories that speak to our higher values, to not just our need for safety and security and status, but the stories that, as you know, in the hero's journey, the stories that really move us are stories that talk about community or stories that talk about creativity or justice. So I think that the price of admission for telling stories in this new oral tradition is going to be speaking to higher values. And we see that, you know, absolutely everywhere. The most iconic brands are all higher value brands these days. And in this sort of more transparent world, if you're going to be speaking about values, you're going to find people out there who are going to be investigating whether or not you're really living those values. That's what we saw with the Danske Bank ad. And that's what we see, you know, nearly constantly, almost every day, are advertisers really taking a deeper look at themselves and saying, you know, are we able to live up to these values we espouse? Because if we're not, we're going to get the exact opposite effect from our advertising. So I think that there can be, in this rush to tell stories, which I can, you know, say pretty clearly as I've traveled around speaking about storytelling, every company and brand out there is seeking better ways to tell stories. I think it gives them a new impetus to be values-based, and I think as the public, it gives us a new responsibility to make sure and hold them to their values so that we can work together to kind of create a more positive world.
Very good. Let me ask you just one question that's been occurring to me as I was preparing for this, and I haven't, I mean, this is not a big question, it's just a little one. It seems to me that one of the things that, as I've watched commercials and friends of mine who direct commercials and so on over maybe even the last 10 years, so some of this goes back before the participation had gotten as strong as it does now, with commercials that are almost a series, 30 seconds packed with mini vignettes, right? Mm-hmm. It's just a moment of these two people, a moment of these two people, a moment of this person, a moment without a person, and they're just, you know, one after another, edited to some sort of soundtrack, and that's the communication. Is that storytelling?
Well, you know, some of those done well are probably part of a storytelling strategy. Some of those done poorly are probably just copycats without really understanding what they're doing. I think what you're seeing there, if done right, and how that connects to storytelling is this. Brands themselves don't just tell stories, but brands themselves are stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're stories that kind of star themselves and the audience in this kind of unfolding drama. And as you know, like the brands that we most love, we tend to identify with. We want to be part of their stories. So if a brand can really understand what its core story is, like I said, what its values are, what moral of the story it stands for, what kind of character that wants to put on the surface of that story, then it can create a communication that simply flashes images of the kinds of heroes that they want to talk about, of the kind of value that represent the kind of values that they stand for, that represent those kind of truths about the world. And it does build that larger story in our minds. We create that story ourselves about who that brand is and who we are in relation to it. So I wouldn't say that that ad necessarily, the flashing images are necessarily a narrative, but they are part of building a larger brand narrative that, you know, gives the brand its power.
Right. And one of the things I've thought is that if you have already established a brand narrative, then you're freer to do this kind of almost association imagery that then the audience can attach to an existing identity or an existing narrative.
Yeah, there's a perfect example of that. You know, I'm sure everyone's tired of hearing about Apple. I'm tired of talking about Apple, but let's talk about them one more time. You know, Apple is a perfect example of that, the sort of the most iconic brand of our time. It did exactly that. It started with a story that it wanted to tell, which is that 1984 ad, that classic ad where we see this new computer as an act of rebellion against conformity and an act of rebellion against like machines taking over our lives, using the themes of George Orwell's 1984.
Yep.
And suddenly, for the first time, we're asked to believe that a computer is a new tool for our own personal creativity, not something to make our lives easier and do the work for us. People, you know, that ad was shown once during the Super Bowl. It's still the most famous top-rated television ad of all time, and it set the story up for what Apple wanted to be. It was a very rich 60-second commercial. Then it was a full 10 years later that they were able to put out those Think Different ads, mm-hmm. which just showed one picture in two words, you know, Einstein and Gandhi and Amelia Earhart, and said Think Different. Those ads were incredibly simple, but they were part of the, you know, understanding what that story was, which is that Apple is a rebellious brand, a rebellion against conformity. We understand what it means then to see a computer ad that's just a picture of a famous person who was a rebel and those two words. So once you establish that story and it starts to resonate, you can tell it, you know, over Twitter. You can tell it.
That's right.
A few characters. You can tell it in two words. So that's what, you know. That's what we need to be seeking to do as communicators, is understand what our core story is and not just put out a bunch of unconnected communications. Some of the stuff that I've, you know, learned the hard way is, for some of our clients who really just wanted to go viral at all costs, we came up with some wacky ideas that were pretty funny and pretty out of left field. They approved them because they wanted to go viral. Suddenly they're getting tens of millions of views, and then they step back and ask themselves, wait a minute, is this really in line with who we are? And it can be pretty uncomfortable when you're getting 100,000 views a day to suddenly wonder if you're building brand value or just going viral. And so that's why I think everyone needs to step back and say, wait a minute, what do we stand for? What is our core story before they try to, you know, just reach the world?
Right. Now, I'm going to jump to this because of what we were just talking about. It's sort of later in the conversation. But one of the examples that you point out is the Pepsi Refresh experience, right? Which looks like a fully developed, it doesn't look like something where you just put an image up. It was fully developed, and you can, I'll let you explain what it is. But it didn't have the desired effect, did it?
No, I mean, that was a fascinating example of, you know, doing almost everything right, but mm-hmm. not quite understanding what you're doing in terms of storytelling. So Pepsi, you know, had this idea. Their new campaign was about refreshing everything, and they thought that was the tagline. And they thought, well, you know, this would be great to connect this to social change. You know, why don't we refresh the world and not just refresh people's thirst or, you know, their bodies? So they decided to put together this campaign in which nonprofits would put up ideas and then get grants based on people's votes. So you would, as a nonprofit, you'd put up an idea and then you'd reach out to your supporters, and then those supporters would all vote for your idea, and then you get, you know, up to $100,000 or whatever it was. It's a great social media strategy because now you have all these different organizations reaching out to their passionate evangelists who have a real reason to keep spreading it because they want to see their organizations get the grants. You're pointing to higher values. You're telling a story about a virtuous brand. And, you know, it really worked in that it was the most successful social media campaign of all time. I don't know, remember exactly, but something like 85 million votes came in. So a lot of positive halo effect. But the beverage industry decried this campaign because Pepsi had done it in lieu of doing some Super Bowl advertising, the kind of old school advertising. And they saw their sales of Pepsi, cases of Pepsi, actually drop that year and lose ground to Coke. I think Diet Coke became the number two drink in America for the first time over Pepsi in the year that they did this campaign. So in looking at why that was, that they had the most successful social media campaign of all time, but also were losing sales, it came out that the millions of people who were participating in this campaign, who were aware of social issues, were also aware of the problems with drinking soda. And so you had a very intelligent group of people who were very concerned about the world and also concerned about their own health, and they were not likely to be persuadable by Pepsi to use their product. And that's where there was a real mismatch between the audience and the brand. And yeah, they were happy to take their money, but they weren't going to be willing to to buy their product. I think even one of the grant recipients, one of the big grant recipients, ran a homeless shelter, and he said, you know, I love getting the money, but there's no way I'm going to serve Pepsi to my clients here. So in the end, I think it's important that who you are and what you stand for is aligned with the story that you tell. Not everybody gets to just simply jump in and tell a better story and reap the rewards.
You know, but what's interesting in reflecting on that story is that if there are people at Pepsi that actually, I'm being almost facetious, that actually had the values that they were putting forward in the Refresh Pepsi ad, that, you know, that maybe the benefit of the positive association meant something to them. But I suppose sales is ultimately why you pay for advertising. I'm talking with Jonas Sachs, creative director at Free Range. And is it still Free Range Studios or is it just Free Range now?
Officially Free Range Studios.
Oh, still Free Range Studios. Okay. Yep. Creative director at Free Range Studios and author of Winning the Story Wars, Why Those Who Tell and Live the Best Stories Will Rule the Future. And you can learn more at freerangeoneword.com. Let me ask you just a little bit about the title.
Mm-hmm.
Why Winning the Story Wars? And that seems like such an aggressive, an aggressive image. And then in the subtitle, you don't just say why those who tell the best stories, you say live the best stories will rule the future. A little bit about the thinking that went into that, because obviously someone who does what you do thinks a lot about what they label their book.
Sure. I wanted to create not just another business book that gives you, 10 tips towards better communication. I wanted to kind of create a story itself. And so the book is illustrated and full of kind of fun visualizations of what this world looks like. And, great stories are often based on big conflict. The conflict between good and evil, the conflict between, one force pushing for one world and one force pushing in another. And I really do believe, while I would never want to be a military recruiter or actually ask anyone to engage in violence, I do believe that there is a battle going on out there, to create the future, and that there are some very big ideas that are being batted around and gasping for air and trying to be heard about, what the future of sustainability is going to be, what the future of our culture is going to be. And they're very much in contrast with some of the values of the past that I believe are no longer working. And so I think that there is a battle for kind of control of the stories that will create our society. And I think the drama of the idea of Story Wars, to me, just In fact, it was the title that, for when it first came up, that we're working with my editor, really sold me on doing the book. I didn't want to write a book about, 20 ways to be a better communicator. I wanted to write a book that would feel epic in scale. And so, I have definitely heard blowback from my peace activist friends that we shouldn't be promoting the idea of war, and I certainly don't. But as Joseph Campbell kind of said, the myths have always had this sort of battle component to them, that the hero comes into contact with the dragon and has to slay the dragon in an act of violence in order to renew the world. And I think that that's really a metaphor for our own struggle within to overcome our darker desires and to overcome our laziness or resistance to change and to reach for our higher values. So I think that there's a lot of, I knew it would speak to me. I knew I'd want to pick a book up like that off the shelf and, hope my audiences would as well. The idea of, not just telling, but living the best stories to rule the future, kind of came to me about halfway through the process of writing the proposal for the book, which was saying, yes, it's important that we tell better stories. And yes, I hope that if we tell more higher value stories, the world will become a better place. But it's not enough. Changing our media landscape would be great. We all talk about how damaging it's been to see all of these negative advertising methods, and it would be great to change that. But we also need to see that people will actually, live out the behaviors and the values that they're espousing. So as I started writing the book, it was more of a hopeful kind of, the price of admission is being in line with your values and actually living them out. But the more I investigated brands that failed to live out their values and failed to live out the stories that they were telling, the more amazing evidence I found for the fact that it's actually not just a moral prerequisite, but it's actually a business imperative, that if you're telling stories and not living them, they're going to backfire. And they do, time and again. And BP was one of the most famous examples of a very positive, higher value story that was not being lived. And it wasn't just a story that became embarrassing when the Deepwater Horizon spill happened, But I actually argue in the book that that story might have in some ways caused the spill itself. That in a kind of concept of groupthink, the leaders of BP were unable to see that they were actually acting recklessly and dangerously. They were the most highly fined and cited oil company out there, but they were also the most virtuous in terms of branding with their Beyond Petroleum thing. And in the concept of groupthink, when you believe that you're morally correct, you are totally blind to the liabilities of your actions. And that's a, you know, known psychological phenomenon. So when a brand gets really holier than thou and moralistic in its advertising, and it's not living those morals out, they're actually failing to see what needs to be done to run a healthy business. So I think there's lots of reasons why you have to live out your brand values or kind of face not just blowback, but actual business problems as well.
Right. That's interesting what you say about BP. There is that expression, people buy their own PR.
Right.
And what you're saying is that when everyone seems to believe, if you'll pardon the other metaphor, that the emperor has clothes on, you begin to mm-hmm. think you have them yourself. And yeah. And I think it's quite interesting that, they actually not only said we can get away with this, but mm-hmm. you're suspecting maybe even went one level deeper and didn't think they were getting away with anything.
Yeah, right. Well, that's right. I mean, I think they had something like 700 safety violations to ExxonMobil 10 over the course of a decade.
Yes, I know.
And when it happened, Gordon Hayward, the CEO, said in privacy, it was reported, but he said it in privacy with his staff. He said, well, what did we do to deserve this? He was shocked. And, you know, that number is staring you right in the face. But they didn't see that number, and they couldn't internalize that number because they thought they were the good guys. And
yeah.
So I was amazed. I always wondered about that quote, and I want to investigate it further. How could they ask that question? And then that's when I discovered these, you know, properties of groupthink that do make this happen.
Yeah.
Hello, this is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my 2012 conversation with Jonas Sachs about his influential creative work and his book, Winning the Story Wars,
Why Those Who Tell and Live the Best Stories Will Rule the Future. Let me ask you a few things about the use of story, because as we know, your purpose now and your clients now are often causes, often organizations, that sort of thing. Is it possible, do you think, to speak of not just story in what you put out to the public, but actually developing a story culture within your organization? Does that concept make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a somewhat unnatural and artificial construct to have a bunch of people come to an office every day and, you know, have to act in constant teamwork, whether they're best friends or don't really like each other, and be under the leadership in a sort of non-democratic way of a corporate structure. All those things are, you know, difficult to keep that ship moving in a positive and productive way. And so there's obviously millions of books about leadership about how to do that, but telling a story that is shared among that team, a sense of purpose, something that team stands for, that, you know, again, to use the war metaphor, that, you know, sends them into that gives them marching orders and sends them into battle. Like, we use stories to create, to compel people to go to war, and that has worked for decades or millennia even, and give them a sense of shared purpose and of common bond. And we can use that in a much more productive way to kind of create a culture, a common culture that makes us, you know, care about helping our fellow worker and care about making the purpose of the company move forward, and not just, you know, see more profits for management, but to actually get us all bound together in a common purpose. And it creates a sort of social compact between the leaders of the organization and everybody else that, you know, here are the values we stand for, and here's how we're going to work to live them out. I talk a lot in the book about how once you understand what your values are, it can be a powerful focusing agent for how you work internally and work together. So I think that that's one piece of it. Second is that when you understand what kind of stories you're trying to tell, a lot of the best stories come from the people working within the organization. So instead of having to go to your ad agency and buy an expensive advertisement, you can start collecting stories from your team and from your customers, because you have a sense of what kind of stories you're looking for, and then you can, as you play them out in the world, you can start gathering them from the people who are engaged in them. So I think having that, you know, joint sense of purpose and joint story that everybody's contributing to and is unfolding together, you know, creates a happier, more productive workplace and better enterprises.
Yeah, and I see that that story culture and that gathering and distributing as being sort of mutually feeding loop.
As you tell people we care about stories, they begin noticing them, then they begin influencing, you know, and it all sort of feeds itself. I actually, in some of my work with organizations, talk about, and I want to test this one with you too, of the idea that it is worthwhile to begin to see the world through narrative. Not just, you know, gather stories, not just develop your group story, your organizational story, but begin to see the day-to-day work you do and the problems you're dealing with and all of these things in a sense of narrative, because I think that way of looking at the world makes us see connections better, makes us see action and consequence better. Your thoughts about that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, stories were developed by human beings to make sense of all the, you know, flood of data that is the world. You know, and if you look from a kind of biological perspective, it's actually quite amazing that we can sort through the thousands of points of input that are coming at us at all times. And we use stories when things are sufficiently complex and we can't sort out what's the meaning behind them. We use stories to assign meaning to it. So I often think about you know, human beings looking up at the sky, and you know, from the earliest days of our development as a species, we look up at the sky and we want to know what's happening up there. And we create these incredibly rich stories to provide meaning to these points of light that are up there. But in doing that, it's not just kind of idle fun. We come to understand the cosmos in ways that are both metaphoric, but also actually, you know, incredibly advanced in terms of how to understand to use the stars for navigation and for agriculture. And so it helps us make sense of our world in ways that can lead to better and smarter actions, even when they're not literally true in a scientific way. So I think that we see, when seeing our lives as a story, and seeing the day-to-day interactions that we have as a story, and consciously doing that, like you say, that can really empower us to give us a sense of purpose and a sense of meaning and a sense of a way to prioritize, because it helps us clarify our values. It helps us share our values with those around us when we see things in terms of narrative. I have a 4-year-old daughter, and we tell stories every single day, and I'm very aware that the stories I tell her and the outcomes of those stories are teaching her how to behave in the world. So, you know, as we learn to record and encapsulate our lives as somewhat as stories, it helps us sort of turn them from sort of senseless chain of events, which, you know, perhaps they are, but we can apply meaning to them through storytelling, and that's what makes life worth living in a lot of ways.
Right. And one of the things that I think is that when you are seeing in narrative and speaking in narrative, I think it gives you a better position from which to frame the conversations that you're having. You know, and for a lot of people, framing comes up mostly in terms of politics, you know, how the Republicans frame something, how the Democrats, how the Tea Party, how the Occupy and so on. But I think framing is something which goes on all the time. But it's my sense that when it just comes naturally to you or your team to see narratives and speak that way, you're a step ahead already in terms of that framing war, if you will.
Absolutely. Well, here's a story I like to tell, and one that I learned in asking great leaders about how they use storytelling. And I asked Phil Jackson, the legendary coach of the Lakers, you know, how do you use stories to lead to your success? And he's a real storyteller. And he told this really interesting and amazing story about what he did with the Chicago Bulls. And when they were sort of unable to beat the Pistons year after year after year, and the reason for it, he could see the reason for it, which was that the Pistons were dirty players, they made the Bulls angry, and the Bulls had sort of superior skills, but every time the Pistons would knock them to the floor, they'd lose their cool and try to somehow get revenge, and that would totally throw them off their game, and they'd lose year after year after year. And they, as a result, could never win the NBA championship.
Right, let me just jump in. In other words, as soon as you do that, you're playing the Pistons game, and that's what they're better at.
And that's exactly what their strategy was. So Jackson knew what needed to be done. He knew that the players needed to stop responding, but he decided to tell a story. And he told a story that was very close to his heart about the Lakota Sioux, who's a tribe near where he grew up in North Dakota that he had become a blood brother of. And their warrior stories were that before they would go into battle, they would thank the Great Spirit for bringing their enemies to them because their enemies made them better warriors. Mm-hmm. And they were so grateful for that ability to, they would never be great warriors without these enemies. They, in fact, loved their enemies because it drove them to be better. And he told a story to these young men who, you know, I always say you tell a story to make the listener feel like the hero of the story. And, of course, a warrior story, a spiritual warrior story to these young men who themselves saw themselves as warriors in many ways on the court, was incredibly resonant. And it was incredibly easy to remember. And it became it made sense. You know, anyone who hears that story, it says, oh, yeah, it's self-evidently true in a way I've never thought of before, which great stories always do. And he said from that, you know, before he told us the game, he told that story, they went out with a new sense of calm and peace. They wound up winning that game. They wound up winning the series. They wound up winning 6 championships. And he said, you know, that was the breakthrough with that story. And I think we can all do that kind of thing, because all we have to do is ask ourselves a simple question, which is, how do I know that? So when Jackson said, it's better in life to be peaceful and centered and not be provoked, he could have just said that to his team, but instead he asked himself, God, how do I know that? And that brought up a story. Somewhere in his life he learned it, and he was able to tell the story of how he learned it, and that was the way to pass it on. So when we're looking to teach someone a core truth about the world, instead of just telling that, espousing this idea, which could be true or not, ask ourselves, what occurred in my life that let me learn and believe that? And if we don't have if we don't have any experience that taught us that, if we just sort of heard it as an aphorism, it's not going to be very powerful. But if we had an incredible experience in our lives, or a friend had a powerful experience, we can tell that story, and people start nodding their heads and changing their behavior. So that simple question of, you know, what do I want to say, and then how do I know that? How did I learn that? And then teaching that moment, using that moment as a story, is a very powerful tool for leadership.
I think that's very, very interesting what you just said, that thing of how did I learn it? Because that almost always will be a story. It won't always be, right, as in Jackson's case, a story about a story, which that one is. But it might be, I had these problems and I tried this and I tried, and whatever it is, it yes, you're right, that the narrative of how we each learn something is an incredibly powerful tool in how we could each teach something.
Exactly. Because, yeah, we need to learn lessons from the world. And so instead of going out and making those same mistakes yourself or having to learn the lesson the hard way, we can learn from each other's experience. And that's where, you know, stories are ways of transmitting experience, not just ideas.
Exactly. This is that's the voice of Jonas Sacks. He's a creative director at Free Range Studios. Their website is freerange.com. And we're talking about the ideas in and around his book, Winning the Story Wars. I want to jump to some of the specifics, as much as your book is not a how-to book, it's bigger than that, some of the specifics, and let me just throw these 3 things out to you and let you run with them, which is familiars, cheats, and freaks.
Yeah. So when I was trying to write the book, my first goal was, how do I write a book that teaches everybody how to go viral? And then I stepped back from that and said, well, that's a big task, and maybe not possible that everyone can be viral. So the first thing I said was, well, let me teach people first what stories are and then how to build an entire long-term strategy around telling stories. But I didn't want to leave on the table this possibility that we could do certain things to just make our stories more compelling. So once you kind of decide, okay, this is the kind of story I want to tell, this is how I tell it, the freaks, cheats, and familiars thing will help you make it that much more interesting by putting some key viral elements into it. And I came up with these 3 names, these 3 ideas, by looking at neurobiology, looking at how the human brain developed in its physical form and how it works. So the first thing I found out was that 70,000 years ago, when our ancestors first sort of broke off and started leaving Africa, we had a certain brain structure, and that brain structure has not changed at all in the last 70,000 years. Physically, we have the same brains as our earliest common ancestors, and if you raised someone from 70,000 years ago in our modern society, you wouldn't know that they were one of our earliest ancestors. And so whatever was important and interesting to the human brain 70,000 years ago is still going to be what's important and interesting to us today. And that brain was evolved as a matter of life and death to sort out what's important from all the noise around us, so that we could see that lion about to attack us, as opposed to just seeing more of that grass swaying in the wind. And so what we can learn from that is that in this incredible stream of information that we get through the internet and through all these communication tools, our brains are looking for certain key things, and if we use those keys, we can actually get heard and break through. So the first of them I talk about is freaks, and that is the idea that human beings are social animals, and that means that our brains are very, very focused on understanding the intentions and emotions of other human beings. So one of the first things we look for in any sea of information is other human faces. We're obsessed with human faces. And That's why telling stories and talking about characters is so much better than talking about facts or figures or simply ideas. But it's not just any human face that we like to see. We are most interested in human faces that look different than any human face we've seen before, because we grew up in these tribes of about 80 people, and we rarely saw anyone that we didn't know. But when we did see someone that looked different, that was, you know, life or death opportunity. That was huge. That could be a huge threat. It could be something huge to bring us new ideas and trade. And so we would really hone in. And we still see that today. When we see someone who looks different than anyone we've seen before, we can't help but stare. And so even though we try not to. So this idea of freaks is that when you tell stories, try to show characters that are totally unexpected. This is why, you know, giants and minotaurs and animal gods tend to inhabit our legends. This is why we love the story of, you know, the high school dropout who becomes the billionaire CEO. We love stories that break our expectations of how characters look and behave. And if you can bring those to your stories instead of putting forth the same old bland everyman or everywoman in your stories, you can really start to break through. And it helps you really focus on those characters, not just putting characters in, but really making interesting characters. The second is cheats. The idea behind cheats is that biologists believe that stories are universal to human beings, and they actually are key to holding societies together. And they were developed for a simple reason, which is this. As survival of the fittest animals, we tend to want to compete with each other. You know, whoever can get the most meat will be able to raise the most kids and get the most nutrition. But we also have to cooperate to be able to, you know, to be able to outcompete other tribes, and also to, you know, bring that animal down to begin with. So cooperation is very important, and so is competition. So how do you hold it all together? Well, you need altruism. You need rules by which people cooperate. And stories are so powerful because we tell these stories about what happens to people who break the rules. Like Sisyphus, he has to roll a boulder up a hill for all eternity because he was a bad innkeeper. He had bad hospitality. He killed his guests. So we know from that story that if we are not hospitable, we're not altruistic, we will be punished. And some people even think the whole idea of God came about as a way of saying, you know, don't break the rules or you will be punished. But in any case, stories tend to be, and we're tend to program to listen to stories that tell us what happens when people break the rules. And in the old stories, you know, we want to see them punished. The person doesn't listen to their parent. They go out into the woods and the witch eats them. And we learn from that, listen to your parents. But now, in our society where social norms are really in question, we also love stories about people who break the rules and get away with it or change the world. So those are the rebel stories. And we love stories about people who you know, stand up to injustice and the old ways of doing things and fundamentally create something new. So I think that, you know, the idea of cheats is our stories don't just have to be about conflict. They have to be about conflict about the old ways of doing, conflict against the old ways of doing things. And whether we want to see them succeed or fail in that rebellion is what makes a story really interesting and gives it drama. And then familiar is finally is just the idea that, you know, the audiences are really the hero of the story. The storyteller is never the most important character in the story. It's really the audiences who are placing themselves in that story and should be thought of as the hero. And in order to make that work, you have to be telling a story that's relevant to their lives. So back 70,000 years ago, the storyteller would always start by bringing the story into the language of the tribe and into what was relevant to them before starting to, you know, just talk about something they'd never heard about. And so, you know, in our marketing these days, we tend to make ourselves the hero of the story. We tend to just talk about what we care about as if others will care about it too. But really, we need to encode our stories in the conversations that our audiences are already having. Make them feel that this is written specifically for them and their culture, and then move them slowly to our new ideas instead of hitting them over the head with our new ideas without first encoding it in the stories that they're already telling. So I kind of talk a lot in the book about how to do that, but I think adding those three pieces are sort of key to telling stories and not just blabbering on in ways that people want to understand.
Right. So let me just a lot in there. Let me just see. So the first, it seems to me, is the familiar. That you want to engage people in something where they think it, because what we do, I think, as creatures, as you described, is there's lots of stimulus. Does this stimulus matter to me or not? Is it about me or not? Is it speaking to me or not? And so that first one is something that hooks people in that says, okay, this is about me or for me, right? And that's the familiar. And then what you're saying is to make it not just that you'll look at it for a second, but that you'll actually care about it, remember it, repeat it, all those sorts of things. That's where it's familiar, but it's remarkable. It's, yeah. It's, and that's where the cheats and the freaks come in, right? Freaks is
something that stands out, and cheats is something which breaks the rules.
That's a great summary, yeah.
Fair enough. Okay. Another very quickly, if you will, you point out, one thing that's interesting is you go back and you look at the history of marketing, because this is about marketing, whether it's, a product, a business, a cause, an idea, whatever. And you go back and you look at John Powers. And first of all, I'm just going to quote his key advice, because it's still so true. Be interesting, tell the truth, and live the truth. And it seems like that just informs your whole book. But the other thing that I'd like you to speak just briefly about, because we've only got about 6 minutes left, and I want to ask one other bigger question after you finish this, is the deadly sins of marketing. So we've said familiars, cheats, and freaks are positive things to look for and use. The deadly sins are vanity, insincerity, puffery, and gimmickry. What's he saying there?
Well, those are not John Powers. Those are mine. But the idea of those is that, you know, the broadcast era basically just made us lazy. It gave us tools to communicate, and we didn't really have to tell stories anymore. So we started communicating in these ways, creating this marketing language that, you know, frankly, just is not good storytelling. And so things like, you know, vanity, I touched on it before a little bit, is we talk about ourselves thinking that we're so important when really we need to be talking about our audiences. Insincerity is the idea that we can just sort of disguise our, in the kind of like a wolf in sheep's clothing, we can speak to our audiences as if we're one of them when we're really not. And that's kind of the Pepsi case. So not really looking at who we are, but really just thinking about who our audiences are and just trying to speak their language when it's not authentic to us. Puffery is, you know, speaking in the voice of God, which, you know, go out and buy a Cadillac. There's never been a better time. You know, that was something that worked on a radio advertisement. It doesn't work in the viral era. So before we can even start becoming better storytellers, I think we need to confront that marketing language of the past that we've all grown up with, we all reflexively use. And by naming it, we can kind of check ourselves and not have to use them. And I actually, you know, talk about five of the deadly sins in the book that we can start, you know, resisting right away.
Okay, finally, let me just ask you this, Jonas Sachs of Free Range Studios. And as I said, you can learn lots more. Their website has newly been redesigned, and their whole image of what they're representing has been redesigned, and that's all at freerange.com. And the book is Winning the Story Wars. If I'm an organization or a cause, and I get lucky enough to sit next to you on an airplane or something, and I say, what do I do? Where do I start? What are the two or three things, and this is what I'm putting out there for listeners who have things they want to advance, what are the two or three things I should ask myself first if I want to begin to move in this direction?
I think first you should ask yourself, what is it about what you're saying that what you stand for that you're having so much trouble communicating or being heard on? What are the things that are standing in the way of truly being heard? And asking yourself, given that 30 seconds to speak to people and given 30 seconds to actually whisper in their ear to your prime target audience, do you have something that's going to move them, or simply is it something that moves you? And I think if you are struggling to connect with people on that sort of emotional heart level, struggling to be heard beyond your own voice, that you can directly communicate with people, it's a very powerful tool to learn how to sort of start building your message around story. And it's, you know, it may be time to start looking into how to tell better stories. And the reason that I wrote the book is, you know, I didn't want people to have to go through the, expensive process of working with us to learn some of the, you know, go on this journey of becoming a storyteller. I want the people to be able to do it for, you know, minimal to very little investment. I'm just, you know, and I think that the book, in my mind, and my hope for it, is that it's a bit of a spiritual journey and not just a practical journey. Becoming a storyteller is a kind of a key human endeavor, and it's always been a incredibly rich and powerful experience for human beings to go down. It's a sort of a hero's journey in itself. And so, I think for anyone who wants to be heard and anyone who wants to engage with a kind of fundamentally but somewhat lost human activity, it's worth pursuing storytelling.
Okay, this would probably be the final question. In terms of how to become a better storyteller, I actually emphasize to people the crucial role of listening to others and to ourselves. And I believe that we need to be present so that our hearts are engaged, so that our story is alive, and that a story isn't something that I sit by myself and formulate and perfect and then throw out there. That, in fact, there's something in the nature of story and narrative that has to do with this process of sharing. And this would be the final question. Your thoughts about that?
I think that's absolutely right. I think that there's so much to listen to in terms of inspiration. I think we can listen to the great tales of the past. We can listen to the stories that moved us when we were children. We can listen to the stories of wise people we know in our lives to draw inspiration for our own stories. And then once we start telling our stories, now we have all these amazing tools to listen to how they're being received. So we can listen to what our audiences think. We can listen to the comments that they give us back. We can listen to how it's being used out in the world in ways that we never could before. So really the actual creation and dissemination of a story is only the midpoint. You know, it should start with that deep listening to the past and to the inputs around us and to our audiences. And then, you know, it should end, or, you know, the back half of the cycle is really listening to how it's being received. And that's just an inherently more respectful way of interacting than standing up on a soapbox and yelling the same message again and again.
Right. That really, this whole thing that's happening nowadays around story and narrative is in some sense at a deeper level really about dialogue and conversation, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So again, the book is Winning the Story Wars, Why Those Who Tell and Live the Best Stories Will Rule the Future. And the website to learn more is freerange.com. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do both of those things at either iTunes or at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. And if you want to receive a weekly email announcement that tells you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and two or three articles about the issues, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at TEMcNally, TEMcNally, at mac.com. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi, and Mark Maxwell in production, Matt Perez in traffic, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week. Finally, thank you to Jonah Sachs. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much for having me.
What's your emergency?
America's healthcare system is broken and people are dying.
Welcome to Code WAC, where we shine a light on America's callous healthcare system, how it hurts us, and what we can do about it. I'm your host, Brenda Gazar. This time on Code WAC, why are doctors so frustrated with our current healthcare system? And why doesn't free market capitalism work with healthcare? To find out, we spoke to documentary filmmaker Maddie Purvis, who is film editor of the documentary Healing Us, narrated by Susan Sarandon.
I know how to pronounce maybe a few things in the medical world. And one of the things that Dr. Dooley says when she's on the phone is that these people she's on the phone with also don't know how to pronounce medical terms because they've never had a medical terminology course. She's spending her days on the phone with people who have no idea what they're talking about, and they have their own quotas, and they're probably getting paid not enough to be doing the job that they're doing, which is tedious, just so that they can go through their little checkbox. I love the way that Dr. Dooley says that too. And essentially try to stumble up this doctor so that they can say, we're gonna deny your claim. We're gonna deny this. That's just so easy to just despise. It's a simple, but again, totally just descriptive example of how our healthcare system runs. It's backwards. Think of the time that doctors could be spending administering care and getting to know their patients, as opposed to sitting on the phone with some college kid who doesn't know what they're talking about and has a quota.
Get the full Code WAC story on progressivevoices.com and on the PV app. Catch all our episodes by subscribing to Code WAC wherever you find your podcasts. This podcast is powered by Heal California, a nonprofit that uplifts the voices of those fighting for healthcare reform around the country. Until next time, stay healthy.
Hi, it's radio veteran Nicole Sandler. Sadly, the radio we all grew up listening to and the industry in which I worked for 40 years has been decimated.
I turned up the radio. I can't hear it.
Thanks to the Telecommunications Act of 1996, a handful of giant corporations control what you hear on the so-called public airwaves all across the nation.
So you had better do as you were told. You better listen to the radio.
But times have changed.
Turn it up, a little bit higher. Radio.
It's the 21st century, and at Progressive Voices, we're reclaiming our time.
Radio.
Progressive Voices, now powered by TuneIn, speaking truth to power 24/7 on the Progressive Voices Network.